So imagine receiving like an email from your 80-year-old grandfather,
Right.
and you open it up, and you're probably expecting the usual stuff,
Yeah.
right? Like maybe a family recipe or just some general life advice, maybe updates on their
Correct.
neighbors.
Just normal grandfather thing.
Exactly. But instead, you are hit with this dizzying, highly detailed manifesto, and it's documenting 70 years of just relentless reinvention.
Yeah, it's wild.
We're talking about a timeline that jumps from like betting on bowling between his legs at age 13 to directing supersonic military jets to literally fleeing the KKK in the middle of the night.
It is quite the resume.
It really is. So welcome to today's deep dive. We are exploring a deeply unique piece of source material today. It's not a textbook. It's not a white paper. It is a 2020 email written by a man named Clint Matheny, addressed directly to his teenage grandchildren.
Right, and the premise of this email is actually remarkably straightforward. You know, at 80 years old, Clint realized he had never actually written down all the jobs he'd held. So he just decided to document every single role, every side hustle, and every career pivot he made, starting all the way back from age 5 right up to age 75.
Which is just a massive span of time. And the mission for our deep dive today is to explore how this 70-year chronological list holds a really fascinating blueprint for a life well lived.
Exactly.
We're looking at the actual mechanics of how a person continuously adapts to a changing world, you know, without losing their core identity.
Okay, let's unpack this by setting the scene where it all starts.
Let's do it.
So it's the mid-1940s. We are in the low-income apartments of Pineville, Louisiana, and a 5-year-old entrepreneur is about to launch his very first venture.
Yeah, and it is a highly resourceful debut into the workforce, honestly.
Oh, totally.
At 5 years old, Clint decides he's going to make and sell perfume door to door.
Perfume at 5.
Right. He hollows out acorns and fills them with his father's Wild Root Cream Oil hair tonic.
I know, right? He caps them off, walks around the apartment complex, and he actually sells them to his neighbors for 5 cents a piece.
And he managed to sell about 20 of them before the hair oil ran out.
Which is impressive.
It is. It's such a great image. But, you know, it's the job he takes right after this, from ages 6 to 8, that I think establishes a serious foundation for the rest of his life.
Right, the paper route.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Clint gets a morning paper route. He's delivering the Grit newspaper. And for context, Grit was essentially the USA Today of its era.
Highly visual, packed with photos.
Right. And he's delivering it every Wednesday to 12 different apartment buildings.
And consider the logistics of that for a second. You have a kid in the first or second grade managing a route across a dozen buildings.
It's a lot of responsibility.
It is. But what's fascinating here is Clint's own reflection on this period isn't about the logistics or the money at all.
No.
He notes that the people living in those apartments were often just incredibly lonely. They didn't really just want the
They
newspaper.
wanted someone to talk to.
Exactly. And Clint explicitly cites this, like listening to these lonely neighbors at age 6, as the very beginning of his training to become a psychotherapist 35 years later.
Wow. And I really want to focus on that early accumulation of experiences. Because when you read through the rest of his childhood odd jobs, it strongly resembles like the tutorial level of a complex video game.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Right. Like when you start a game, you're usually just running around a safe zone, picking up random items, testing out basic skills.
Yeah, just hitting buttons to see what they do.
Exactly. You have no idea how these specific mechanics are going to serve you in the main quest. You're just gathering them.
Yeah, that's the exact mechanism at play here. I mean, he isn't building a resume yet. He's building a foundational skill set. By age 9, he's mowing lawns. Then he's selling ice cream from a bicycle cart from noon until sundown.
And he actually notes in the email that he didn't wear a helmet because they literally hadn't been invented yet for bicycles.
Right, it was a different time. Then he works as a grocery bag boy, a drugstore soda jerk.
And then at 13 years old, he gets so proficient at pool, snooker, and bowling.
Oh, the bowling thing is wild.
Specifically, he figures out how to bowl between his legs with a really high degree of accuracy. And he actually starts making money betting on those skills against older kids and adults.
Which takes a lot of nerve. But look at the common denominator in all those tutorial-level skills.
Okay.
They all require a high level of environmental awareness and interpersonal negotiation. He is learning how to read a room.
Yeah, the environment shifts. It's an apartment hallway, then a drugstore counter, then a smoky pool hall.
But the core mechanic is observing human behavior. He is basically compiling this massive internal database of how people operate, what they need, and how to interact with them.
Right. But, you know, he's building this database in a very specific environment.
Yeah.
Empathy and reading people in a vacuum is one thing, but empathy in the segregated Deep South of the 1950s is an entirely different reality.
Oh, absolutely.
And this brings us to a really sharp pivot in his teenage and early adult years. This is where that empathy collides with survival. It's a period we can really view as his moral crucible.
Yeah, the historical context shifts from just being background noise to a direct daily obstacle. The rules of a segregated society are strictly enforced at this time, and the consequences for defying them are immediate and often violent.
Yeah.
So we see Clint's internal database of human behavior repeatedly crash into these systemic rules.
Right. Let's just lay out the facts of these encounters exactly as Clint documents them in the email. So at age 15, he's working as a car hop at the Sip and Nip Drive-In restaurant.
Okay.
It is a freezing winter night. A black army sergeant and his wife pull up, and Clint invites them to come eat inside the restaurant where it's warm.
Right.
That very same night, the KKK burned a cross in the drive-in's parking lot. And Clint was fired early the next morning.
Wow. And the consequence is immediate. But the thing is, his behavior doesn't change. Later that same year, still at 15, he takes a job at a dry cleaner. And he's fired again. The stated reason for management was that he was referring to the black woman who worked there as ma'am.
Jeez.
And he learned years later that the owner of the dry cleaner was actually a local KKK leader.
Which is terrifying. Yeah. And then fast forward a few years, Clint is 22. He's working a construction job right before he's scheduled to move on to a new career.
Right.
During a shift, he witnesses a foreman physically kick a black ditch digger. Clint intervenes and shoves the foreman.
Good for him.
Yeah. And then he discovers a massive wage discrepancy. Simply for being white, Clint was being paid 15 cents more an hour than the black workers doing the exact same manual labor.
Wow.
So he reports the construction company to the Department of Labor for wage violations, and he is, predictably, fired again.
Right, but this specific incident acts as the catalyst for the rest of his life.
How so?
Well, after the altercation and the report to the Labor Department, someone working at the U.S. Post Office places a business card in his mother's locked mailbox.
In her locked mailbox.
Exactly. And the card simply reads, "The eyes of the KKK are on you, Clinton Matheny."
Oh, my God.
It is a direct threat, and it forces him to flee town early just to protect his family.
You know, I have to play devil's advocate here and look at this from a purely pragmatic standpoint.
Sure.
It's easy for us to sit back decades later and see the morality of his actions, right?
Hmm.
But in the moment, he is putting a massive target on his own back. And more importantly, on his mother's back.
A KKK threat in a locked mailbox is no joke.
Exactly. From a sheer survival standpoint, this level of repeated defiance seems almost recklessly stubborn. I mean, most teenagers or young adults in that era would just keep their heads down to keep a paycheck and stay alive.
Yeah, that was the norm.
So was he acting on a deeply held moral imperative? Or was he just a teenager incapable of keeping his mouth shut? Why did he continuously risk his livelihood and his life to do this?
It is a completely valid question. And to answer it, we have to look back at the mechanics we discussed earlier. This ties directly into that early empathy training.
From the paper route.
Yes. In psychology, there's a concept that deep individualized empathy acts as an inoculation against dehumanization.
Okay, makes sense.
When you spend your formative years at 6 and 7 years old, actively listening to people, recognizing their individual loneliness and humanity.
You literally cannot unsee their humanity.
Precisely. Systemic cruelty like segregation requires a population to actively dehumanize a group of people.
Right.
Clint's internal database was built on the premise that everyone has a story and deserves to be heard. So when he invites a freezing couple inside or says, ma'am, or stops an assault, he isn't executing a coordinated political protest.
He's just being human.
Right. He is acting on an individual ingrained imperative. The empathy simply overrides the instinct for self-preservation. He cannot compute the logic of letting someone freeze or watching a coworker be kicked, regardless of the societal rules.
And the consequence of that empathy overriding his self-preservation is that he gets chased out of town.
He does.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Getting chased out of town turns out to be the spark that ignites this incredibly prolific, polymathic phase of his life.
Oh, totally.
He moves to Amarillo, Texas, and we enter an era spanning from age 23 to 63 that completely redefines how we think about a career path.
Because, you know, we live in a society that pressures us to specialize early. We're supposed to pick a lane, climb the ranks, and define our entire identity by our job title.
Like, I am a banger.
Exactly. But if you look at Clint's resume during these 4 decades, It is a masterclass in refusing to do that. He treats his career not as a fixed trajectory, but as an exercise in constant adaptation.
Yeah, the volume and variety of the roles he takes on is staggering. Mm-hmm. I mean, before he even left town, he had joined the army at 17, working as an infantryman and a legal clerk.
Right.
And while he was enlisted, he was running a side hustle, offering low-interest payday loans to his fellow soldiers. Like, he would lend them $20, and they would pay back $25 on payday.
Which, by the way, was less than half the going interest rate on the base at the time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it shows that the Acorn Perfume entrepreneurial drive was still very much active.
Definitely.
And then at just 20 years old, he becomes a house parent at a reform school overseeing 30 boys.
See, I'm trying to map this out logically. How does a 20-year-old effectively manage 30 boys in a reform school? He's a kid himself. He's 15 years younger than the next youngest house parent.
You map it out by looking at the blocks he's already gathered. If we connect this to the bigger picture, his career is not a staircase. It is a bucket of Legos.
Okay, I like that.
Every odd job he had was a distinct Lego block. He takes the discipline and structure block from the army, snaps it together with the reading a chaotic room block from the pool hall.
Right.
And anchors it all with the listening to lonely people block from his paper route.
Right.
When you combine those specific mechanics, you have the exact toolkit required to manage 30 troubled youths.
That is such a fascinating way to look at skill transfer. And we see him disassemble and reassemble those blocks constantly.
Constantly.
Like after moving to Amarillo, he starts a career as an FAA air traffic controller.
Yeah.
He spends years in this field, eventually working across six different facilities.
Yeah.
At the exact same time, he earned his private pilot's license.
And he isn't just flying small commuter planes either. He logs hours in a Cessna 150, a Beechcraft, a DC-9 commercial jet, and then moves on to supersonic military jets like the T-38 and the F-4.
He even logs time flying the Goodyear blimp.
Just for fun.
Right. But here is the pivot that really forces us to examine the mechanics of reinvention. At age 36, Clint resigns from the FAA.
Yeah.
He leaves a secure government job directing air traffic to open a calibration and metrology lab called Gulf Coast Calibration.
A lab that still exists today, by the way.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
How does a person go from directing supersonic jets in the sky to calibrating microscopic laboratory equipment? On paper, those two industries have absolutely nothing to do with each other.
Well, on the surface, they looked entirely different. But beneath the surface, the core operating system is identical.
How so?
Think about it. What is air traffic control? It's the management of highly complex systems where absolute precision is non-negotiable. It requires intense focus, the ability to track multiple variables simultaneously, and a zero-tolerance policy for systemic errors.
Because if you make an error, planes crash.
Right. Now, what is metrology and calibration? It's the science of measurement. It is the management of highly complex instruments where, again, absolute precision is non-negotiable.
Oh, I see.
Clint didn't change his core operating system. He just pointed his high-stakes precision Lego block at a different industry. This is the underlying secret to his ability to pivot. He possessed an enormous amount of what psychologists call identity capital.
Let's define that for the listener really quick. What exactly is identity capital in this context?
Sure. Identity capital is the collection of personal assets, your skills, your experiences, your values that you carry with you. But crucially, Clint detached his ego from the noun. Yeah, society trains us to answer the question, what do you do with a single noun? I am an accountant. I am a teacher. When your entire identity is tied to that noun, losing the job or changing industries feels like a death of the self. It's terrifying.
Yeah, it really is. But if you listen to this and you feel trapped in your current career, like maybe you feel the sunk cost fallacy of having spent 10 years in one industry, Clint's approach offers a total paradigm shift.
Exactly.
He was never an air traffic controller or a lab technician. He was Clint, deploying his skills in different arenas.
Precisely. When you don't anchor your identity to a single profession, the fear of starting over completely disappears. It's just another environment to apply your mechanics. And he proves this repeatedly.
Yeah, he eventually returns to the FAA. He starts a private therapy practice. He gets licensed to sell life insurance and mutual funds for New York Life.
It's endless.
It really is. And then in his late 50s and early 60s, he pivots again. He spends years traveling across Alaska and East Africa as a wildlife photographer.
That's a huge shift.
Right. He sets up an online shop and sells prints of his photography for years.
And pay attention to how he handles the end of that specific career block. He stops selling prints around 2009. the reason: the advent of smartphones.
Oh, yeah.
Suddenly, everyone had a high-quality camera in their pocket, and the market for physical wildlife prints just collapsed.
And most people would be incredibly bitter about an entire industry being disrupted by technology like that. They'd complain about the changing times.
But Clint just adapts. The market changed, so he changed the utility of his work. He took his entire digital archive of wildlife photography and donated the files to the African Wildlife Foundation so they could use them for their fundraising calendars.
That's amazing.
The adaptability block was always in place.
It really is a remarkable run of professional agility. But what brings this entire 70-year journey into sharp focus is how the timeline eventually loops back on itself.
Yeah, it's very poetic.
It is. After all the businesses, the supersonic jets, the calibration labs, and the wildlife photography, the final chapters of his working life bring us full circle.
Because from the ages of 64 to 75, Clint returns to part-time therapy.
And in his email to his grandchildren, he makes a very poignant observation about this final phase. He writes that working as a therapist in his 70s was fundamentally going exactly back to what he started doing at age 6.
Right.
He was back to simply listening to people.
It strips away all the noise. After navigating the brutal realities of the segregated South, after managing complex radar systems, the core skill that remained.
The single thread.
Exactly. The single thread pulling 70 years of work together was the simple, profound act of listening to another human being and validating their experience.
We have tracked this man from selling hair oil-filled acorns at age 5 to counseling clients at age 75. Which brings us to the final section of his email, where Clint distills everything he's learned into a message for his teenage grandkids. So what does this all mean?
Well, to anchor this final message, Clint reaches back to a piece of wisdom he received 60 years prior.
Oh, this is the cook, right?
Yes. When he was 20 years old, he spent some time working as a cook's helper and cleanup man on an offshore drilling rig. And the head cook on that rig was an 85-year-old Cajun man.
Okay.
And this cook told a young Clint Matheny, "We get old too quick and we learn too slow."
We get old too quick and we learn too slow.
Man.
Clint says that single sentence stuck with him for 6 decades.
It's powerful.
And it culminates in the ultimate takeaway he leaves for his grandchildren at age 80, he tells them. "When you finally reach the end of your days, you will not look back and wish you had logged more hours at work. The only thing you will long for is more real time with the people you love."
It is a profound statement, particularly because of who is saying it.
Right.
This isn't someone who shied away from work. This is coming from a man who arguably worked more jobs in more varied fields than almost anyone alive. He isn't claiming that work is meaningless. His entire timeline proves that work can be an incredible adventure, a laboratory to test your courage, and a vehicle to constantly reinvent yourself. But he is drawing a definitive boundary. He is separating what we do to live from what actually gives a life meaning.
It completely dismantles our modern obsession with a resume.
Totally.
We spend so much of our lives agonizing over the bullets on a piece of paper, trying to make the gaps look smaller, trying to make the title sound more prestigious. But Clint's story illustrates that a career is just a sequence of mechanics.
It's the Legos you play with during the day.
Exactly. How you treat people, whether that is listening to a lonely neighbor on a paper route, risking your life to stand up for a coworker being abused by a foreman, or prioritizing undistracted time with your family, that is the actual measure of who you are.
That is the enduring legacy. The titles fade, the industries change, but the impact you have on the people around you remains.
We want to thank you for joining us on this exploration of Clint Matheny's life. It is not often we get such an unfiltered, sprawling document that lets us examine the mechanics of a 70-year span of work and character.
No, it's really rare. And as we close out today's deep dive, I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder on your own.
What's that?
Well, we have spent the last few minutes dissecting the threads running through Clint's life. If you sat down today and wrote out every single job, role, or side hustle you have had since you were 5 years old, what hidden underlying value would connect them all?
That's a great question.
If you stripped away the job titles, what is the core mechanic you keep returning to, and is that the value you actually want to be remembered for?
It's a heavy question, but it's the right one to ask. Because if we aren't careful, we might end up looking back at a perfectly sanitized, logical resume, only to realize we missed the messy, beautiful reality of the life we were actually supposed to be living. Keep digging deeper, and we will see you next time.